Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This episode of Ham Nation is brought to you by ICOM. For more information, visit icomamerica.com/hamnation.
This is Ham Nation, episode number 382, December the 26th, the best of 2018 here on Ham Nation. Hello, everybody, and welcome. This is the best of Ham Nation that's happened all year, and we each have our own likes, and mine has been the Pine Board Project. It has really been a wonderful project for me, but even better, we have over 1,000 people building this thing. It's crazy. So we're happy that you are watching, and I hope that you too have enjoyed all of the many other shows and segments inside the great show of Ham Nation, all about ham radio. Well, check this out. Here are a bunch of things that come in from people, you people, that watch the show and build. This is from Virginia. And Virginia, she wanted to go to her club meeting. She had finished the field strength meter. Then she did a beautiful job on the power supply. We'll come back to that. She said, boy, I wish I had time to make the preamp up, but I don't. And I would take it to my club. I said, don't worry about it. I sent her my preamp. So she went to her club meeting. There's her setup that she did at her club meeting. And I'm sure they all enjoyed seeing and hearing about Virginia's project. So we're so proud of what Virginia's doing. And she's now working on the transmitter. So it won't be long. And she'll probably be joining us in the morning. But that's her power supply. And then, of course, our preamp. Well, we get all these things. I just don't have enough time to go through them each day, but each show I'll try to get to a bunch of them here as we go through and in the future. But we're going to start off again with the transmitter, and what you're going to do is go to Hobby Lobby and buy their Pinewood stuff. It's just really cool. It's already finished. It's got a real nice edge on it. Now I took that and I put a little bit of pine, what do they call this, a pine wood something. It's a stain, and I stained it. Now, you'll notice those holes that I've punched with a punch, and what that is doing is I knew exactly where the parts were going, and you want to follow along with some of the things that we do about this guy. This is the layout of the parts, exactly the way they're going to lay on that board. So you can put your terminal strips and all that. So it's just easier to mount them if you have a little bit of some kind of awl or you could do it with a nail and a hammer. But all of these great drawings are up on the website, and we'll talk about that. The first thing you have to do with all of this is you have to do something about the tube socket, because you cannot mount those tube sockets and then try to solder them underneath, because there is no underneath. So what you do is look at all the diagrams we have, and you'll want to wire them beforehand. Wire as much as you can. Here's one of them that Gene did. Gene's the guy that's doing all of these great, great drawings. Thank you so much, Gene. And you'll see he mounted it on a piece of board, and then he marked where the pins are, and that allows him to do all of the pieces and parts, and he's ready to go. Now, you have to mount that on the pine board. And that's been a little bit of a situation in that after we do this and we have our tube socket with everything mounted, as you saw in the drawing, how do you do that? Well, you need a standoff, and we couldn't find standoffs until, and I'm sorry I didn't bring the email, but one of you, thank you very much, said, hey, why don't you go to a local hardware store, and maybe they'll have a lot of this. Well, I do that. I do shop at a lot of the hardware, little hardware stores. We got one here in Pleasant Hope, believe it or not. But I went to Ace Hardware, and guess what I found? I found exactly what we need, a little standoff. The screw will go through the tube socket, and then when you do all this together, that tube socket will be able to stand up above the board. See, I hope you can see that. That's how that works. You need two of them. And they're a whole 43 cents a piece. And, there's the part number. We'll have it in a minute. I'll show it to you on the parts list. But that's what you want to do first, is you want to mount as much as you can on the tube socket, because it makes it really easy then. You turn that baby upside down and you're ready to go. And here and again is a wonderful, wonderful drawing that that Gene made. I just can't talk enough about his work. And he's made it really easy for you. And there it is. And all of these drawings are on the website. Go to HeilSound.com. And we don't sell anything about that. We're just giving you the information. It's a great place for us to put all of these things. It's all down at the bottom past all of our products, and you'll see the Pine Board Project. And there's comments and stuff, and we're talking to each other stuff. It's really great. There is the schematic of the transmitter, and that's the schematic that you just heard Richard transmitting a couple hundred miles away. And it really works great, and it's very simple. Now, I had one other problem when I was doing this. We have a piece of pine board, right? How are we going to mount the SO239? How are you going to do that? Because you can't drill a hole in it. Well, you could, but it'd be kind of stupid. So I took we've shown you how you run the ground path with the number 14 or 12 copper wire, and I made a little cage for it. And, man, it worked out really good. And there is a drawing that Gene has done for us. That's copper wire, and it's really sturdy. It works great, and that's how you'll mount that. I have a switch on it also, a push-to-talk switch, and I did that also. Now, one of the things that we haven't talked about, and we keep reviewing a lot of this because everybody's not together. One's a little ahead of the other and so on, and that is the coil. Very, very important about the coil. And Richard and Gene and I talk about it just about every other day. We're talking about what are we going to do about that coil? And we finally got that nailed really well. And that's from MFJ. The coil that we have and that you heard on the transmitter a minute ago, and my coil, that came from MFJ, and that's the coil that they use in one of their amplifiers. And so they're making this coil for us, though. This one's 41 turns. Their coil for their amplifier is much longer, and they're making this just for us. And you'll notice here I dented one of the turns in, and what that's for is this little clip lead out here, and you attach that in there, and we just went on 40 meters. That's my band switch, okay? And later on, we get all this finished. One of the projects, I'm going to have a lot of little added features. One of them is going to be, we'll put a band switch on this thing. But I've had it on 40 meters. It works great. The band switch right now is this little clip lead, clip right there. I think it's 14 turns. We need the whole coil, 41 turns for 75. But then we have to change the crystal. So what you do is you unplug the 75-meter crystal, and I drilled a couple of little holes right here, and that is my other crystal. That's the support, so I don't lose it. And then you plug that in, and we're on 40 meters, just that quick. And then we can take the 75-meter one and put it in the spare holes so you don't lose it. So there you go. And these are all things we'll talk about as we get along. But one of the things that we want to do is to help you make the coil. And Gene came up with a really cool deal. He got it at Lowe's. And it's a cable. It is right there. It's plastic. It's a cable comb. So if you had a bunch of wires, you could lay them in here and organize a run of cables. Well, you also can take that, go in another section of Lowe's, and get you a little 2-inch, 1.5-inch piece of PVC, and bingo, you can make your own coil. And there are all of the instructions. We'll get into this more thorough as we get along in another couple weeks, but it'll be on the site, so you can read all of Gene's all of his information on how he did it. But you mount these coil combs on to the PVC and just wrap the 14 gauge, and it works great. So that's one way of doing it. And also we have another one where you just wind the coil. And that's kind of fun too, is making the coil. Richard used also an 1.5-inch piece of just PVC, but you have to put it in a microwave oven first. And you're going to go, what? Your wife, your girlfriend, or she's going to say, what are you doing? Well, I'm curing my PVC. What? You have to do that because PVC and RF don't like each other. So you put it in a microwave oven for a couple of minutes, and then you can wind a coil around it. Probably didn't know that, did you? All these crazy things, but it works when you get it all done. There is the complete list, including one that Gene put on there about an hour ago. Put on that Ace Hardware part for the standoff. But that's all of them. Now, again, most of these come from Antique Electronic Supply. You go to their website, which is Tubes and More, and you can put in the search box Ham Nation, and they've got the kits, the power supply, the preamp. I think they've got them all up there now, but be watching because they've got them all set up like that for you. And the only thing is that I would buy my tubes from Tubes, from vacuumtubes.com. They seem to, Mike is he's a ham, and he really has a little better price and so on. So there's where you get your tubes. Crystals, I've got a lot of people coming at me like, what are you going to do for crystals? The International Crystals gone. Yeah, but Bry's still there. AF4K, and he makes great crystals. I've got several of them, and they work perfect. And then AES, Antique Electronic Supply. But that's all of the good things. Here's one other great thing that Gene sent me. That is his transmitter. And that's the coil that we just talked about. And it's really good. What a nice job Gene did there. And that coil is done with that cable comb. Isn't that pretty? Not finished yet, but he's close. So I just wanted to give you some of those insights to what's going on and where we're going. And again, you go back to heilsound.com and you'll be able to see all of these great drawings and comments from people, and it's really great. We're very excited about what's going on with all of this. So thanks to W0BVT, the guy you heard on the recording, for giving me the inspiration. And then, of course, what we do without all these drawings. Well, you know what we did, me and my funky pen on a black, on a whiteboard. Well, then I want to introduce everybody to the queen of amateur radio, and that's Valerie, NV9L. Hi, Valerie. How you doing?
I'm doing great, doing great. Got little DX tonight. We're also going to talk about, I had Spratly guys were supposed to be on with me tonight, but unfortunately their flight was delayed, so they're in the air right now or maybe just about to land. So I'm kind of ad-libbing with some other stuff, so I'll be getting to that later on in the segment.
Well, I'll fill in a couple of minutes for you, Val, and bring everybody that's watching tonight and listening on the podcast. I got a note today from the Hamvention, and they are telling us that the ham radio operator of the year is none other than Valerie, NV9L. Congratulations, woo-hoo! My friend.
Thank you, guys. I can't even believe I was nominated, let alone win that. You know, I'm just blown away. I still have to pinch myself. So, pretty cool.
There are a few of us out here that know people, and we know how hard you work, not only here, but, I mean, this is just a little piece of what you do now. And let's see, George, you received that award a couple of years ago, right?
Well, it wasn't Ham of the Year. Mine was one of the special achievement awards. I don't even remember what year that was now, but it was certainly a great honor. And Valerie, well deserved.
Thank you. And yeah. I think Gordo also had it. So it's making the rounds. Hopefully one of you guys will get on there next year. We'll just keep it going, get a streak going.
Yeah. I was the Ham of the Year 1982.
Talk about there
an
you
old
go.
Man. And I got it a couple of years after Barry Goldwater got it. It's like, I can't believe this is happening. But
yeah, I'm following a Nobel Prize laureate. I'm like blown away, Joe Taylor. So
well, very yeah. deserved. I have a whole sheet of things about what you do, and I want everybody to check it out because she's. She's really gone way beyond. I remember finding her in the chat room, and she was shy, and she wouldn't come on. But then we got her on, and finally, bingo, she opened up to the world. And we're so thrilled and very honored to have you with us because you are the queen of DX. I don't think anybody will deny that you are not because you really are there, and you're – you're a pilot for many of the expeditions. And there it is right there. Copy this down. Do a screenshot, everybody. That'll give you all of the information about Amateur Radio of the Year from the ARRL. And it's the announcement from Hamvention. So we're really happy about that. And, of course, it can't go without telling about your achievement in Puerto Rico. Holy smokes. I mean, you almost put your life on the line for that one, and you did it and did a great thing for a lot of people, and that was just really super. So congratulations, and we appreciate your efforts so very much. And we're glad to have you here always.
Yeah. Thank you, and thanks everyone in the chat room who's given me all those congrats. I really appreciate it.
Hi there, and happy holidays from Gordo, WB6NOA. We so much appreciate all our Ham Nation viewers, not only watching and listening, but also sending us those emails that keep us on track. And one of the most popular topics was small antennas that our neighbors won't see. Well, that, of course, one great design is the loop antenna. So we're going to take a listen and a look and do some experimenting with loop antennas and see that every type of wire bound together in ham radio has a purpose. Maybe the loop won't put out quite as good a signal as a dipole, but by golly, you're getting a signal out, and that's the most important thing. So Ham Nation viewers, Ham Nation listeners. Thank you all for keeping us hosts on track with what you want to see and you want to hear and you want to learn about. And keep those cards and letters and emails coming, because we learn from you, our valued Ham Nation viewers and listeners. Happy holidays for 2018, and let's hope that 2019, the start of Solar Cycle 25, is a grand time for all on the air. 73, here's Loops from Gordo. Well, you've been seeing it in a lot of magazines. CQ talks about it in their latest issue, and I'm very happy to say CQ is now coming back stronger than ever, and that is wonderful. Of course, DX Engineering has it, talking all about loop antennas. So, Victor, if you don't mind, let's go ahead and Jim and I will explore loops. Now, a small magnetic loop antenna can be receive only or transmit. And the transmit is critical because there's a lot of stuff that's slightly different in the transmitting loop than just the receiving loop. So what we see here is about 1/8 wavelength for uniform current distribution throughout the loop as a lumped inductance. That's the loop itself. Maximum power will be a figure eight in the plane of the loop. So right now, if we were to look at that loop, we're not hearing much power. And the short whip or a short dipole is capacitive, and we normally load them with inductance. This lowers the Q, ups the losses, and conversely, for the very high Q and lower losses found in the loop does a marvelous job when tuned in properly. And Jim's going to tell us all about what it takes the mic make the right type of loop. So narrow bandwidth, maybe only 10 kilohertz at 7 megs, but the high Q parallel tuned circuit in a loop gives us incredible gain. Now, to minimize lumped I squared R conductor and capacitor losses that go up in heat, and of course going up in heat means losing energy, here's a ham that homebrew the losses to a minimum by using wide copper windings and a vacuum variable capacitor, and this is going to give high intrinsic radiation efficiency. Now, these loops can take about 100 watts of power or less. These, and Bob, you remember seeing them at Xenia, Ohio Hamvention. This particular loop can take probably 300 to 400 watts, because there are tens of amps circulating within this loop. And notice at the very top of the loop are the big capacitors. And the capacitors are the key to making a loop antenna play. And of course, the nice thing about a loop like this is that it's portable. It doesn't mind being at least a loop above the ground, no lower than that, but just one loop distance from the ground is all it takes, because the loop does not rely specifically on ground currents. And the loop has both a low as well as a high angle of radiation, and one wavelength loops, the really huge ones that Bob and Don are going to put around their property, they radiate perpendicular to the plane, but this vertically polarized magnetic field within this loop is going to radiate in the loop direction that you see it there. So think of the loop as like a magnetic dipole, whereas an ordinary dipole is an electric. So the higher the Q, the lower the noise, and on transmit, that means no harmonics, and that's a neat thing. Now, loop efficiency is equal to conductor tube diameter and conductivity of skin effect. So the loop of those pliable loops that are great for packing in your vehicle, or as Tracy of the MTARA team does, he sticks it all in a neat backpack with the Alex loop. Flexible conductor low loss coax is a great way to go, remembering that a square root of frequency loss So the better the conductivity of the loop itself, the better that we're going to have a good signal being radiated. Well, a fat tubular conductor with the within the loop element that's smooth and is going to have almost no eddy currents. And you may say, oh, it's not copper, it's aluminum. Well, aluminum has a DC ohmic resistance of only 1.6 a copper, that is DC, but the RF skin effect of both copper and aluminum are close. Copper, the skin effect, the signal only gets 20 microns into the conductor, whereas the aluminum is only a mere 26 into the conductor. But what really makes the difference on the loop antenna with a solid conductor is this right here, and that is the junction between the two conductors with nothing more than a wing nut and maybe a couple of washers that are seated well. Because the magnetic loop has great radiation, but resistance of just a few hundred milliohms, one added milliohm will equal one loss of efficiency. So that's why we want to make sure that any loop connection that you see like this is going to work out as a very low resistance conductor. So the loop at each end of this particular circuit goes to a series capacitor, transformer coupled, and the unshielding coupling loop, that's the one that we put the coax into, is ready to roll. And Jim is here. And Jim, how about telling us what you do on your homebrew loop out of copper to make sure that each and every one of those octagonal joints is not going to have high resistance? Jim?
Well, this is an eight, of course, this is an eight section made out of 10 feet of, I think, 0.9 inch diameter.
Wow.
Copper, and you braze those elements together with this. It's called silvalloy, and silvalloy is available for about $2 or $3 on eBay, and it's 80% copper, 15% silver, and I think 5% phosphorus, and you use a very, very hot breathing to get it on there, but it's easy to do.
Wow. So now you have an octagonal loop, not quite as efficient as they say a round loop, but you've had good results with this, huh?
Absolutely. And that's great if you got all the materials to bend all those, but if you do a good job, I think the difference is something like 5%. So it's really not a big penalty to pay there.
Wow. And as you'll see, Jim is able to get this in his vehicle. Now, the key to getting the signal to be inductively coupled to the loop is this 5-to-1 smaller loop, sometimes called the primary, very similar to the primary of a transformer. And the primary concentrates the magnetic flux lines, which cut the small untuned feed loop. And that equals higher Q, especially on 7 megahertz, but a slightly lower Q as we go higher in frequency, but the efficiency actually is greater. So the impedance of the main loop is independent of frequency, and this little feeder loop right in line with the main loop is what it takes. And this little feeder loop comes in many different configurations. Jim, you did your own, huh?
Yes, I did. And that just a piece of RG8X, and it seems to work just fine.
Absolutely. And Jim and I did some playing around because we had read on the internet that you could reduce SWR slightly by mooshing around the bottom of the feeder loop. And yeah, we saw a change in the SWR, and that change did make a slight difference, but it really didn't in the performance. Now, When folks homebrew their own loops, this is wonderful. Because remember, these small loops will work great in a condominium backyard where you're not allowed an antenna, yet the loop will put out a signal almost equivalent to a half-wave dipole mounted too low to really be effective. And here we see that primary of the transformer feeder loop that is just above the bottom of the main loop. And that feeder loop placement is very important. Here's one held on simply by Velcro, and it's fine. And, you know, it didn't really seem to make a difference whether it actually contacted the main loop or not. It was just the inductive coupling that really makes a difference. And by the way, that main loop, the big part, is about a yard for covering 10, 15, and 20 meters. And it can also cover 40 meters, but you're going to need a larger, about a 2 meter diameter if you want to get to 60 meters and maybe 80 meters. And if you plan to do 160 meters, I mean, your efficiency on a loop is not going to be more than a micron of 1%, but nonetheless, it would have to be as high as 4 meters in diameter. And critical is keep that inner loop perfectly aligned with the outer loop. The inner loop is inductively coupling to the outer loop, and it must be perfectly in line. Now, this is Carl Lavoie of Chameleon, and I said, Carl, can you set us up? Jim was watching in a few seconds or less, a few minutes or less, and bingo, he did. And that's using coaxial cable. I think it's LMR 400 with a solid conductor. So we have good symmetry of that outer loop. And again, the feeder loop is that loop that is on the top. Now, on the bottom is the tuning capacitor. Well, he's got calibration lines, as well as a toggle switch. The lines were not perfectly calibrated, but you tune that big knob quickly, and when you hear the noise really come up, that's your sweet spot. Now, for 40 meters and 60 meters, where Dale and I work U.S. Coast Guard auxiliary comms, we flip the switch, and I believe that's going to add on to the left what is probably, it's supposed to be secret, a capacitor that adds more capacitive reactants to get us down there. Now, this is John Miller, N7 Juliet Delta Mike. He is the one that is very familiar with what's inside the sealed box, and you can contact John at support@chameleonantenna.com. And he's a real good guy, and he says it like it is. So if you're having a problem, especially with one of his loops, he'll tell you what the deal is. Jim, I'm looking at it, and it looks like his feed loop is not in line with the main loop, but maybe he's doing that on purpose. Jim, what have we got here on your homebrew loop?
Well, on top there, that's a fixed capacitor in parallel with the variable, which is necessary for 40 meters. So if I do 40 meters, I put that on and take it off. This is at the top of the loop, and some designs have it on the top, which has got an advantage and disadvantage. The pro is that you don't have to have any magnetic decoupling from the coax if the loop is on the bottom. But of course, when it's on the top, you got something that's top heavy. So pros and cons, like everything else.
Oh, that's great, Jim. And Jim, here's another closer look of what we've got going on with that great connection at the top of the loop. And we'll get to that in just a moment. Victor, if you'll go to that next slide-a-rooney. There we go. Jim, what have you got the copper foil on?
Well, that's right across the aluminum section. This is a two-section capacitor, and the capacitor, the connections are not to the rotation portion or the rotator. It's to reduce any losses because of the rotating joints. So RF does go through the aluminum, so it's bypassed by copper and reduce the losses.
Wow. Well, you've done a great job of that, Jim. And now tell us about the makeup of the capacitor. Boy, it looks pretty close for more than a few 20 or 30 watts on this one.
Well, these are actually, it's two 200 picofarad, 2,000 volt capacitors. And when you hook them in series and just to take the connections from both ends, then it becomes 100 picofarads and 4,000 volts.
And wow, so likely we could run maybe 50 or 60 watts?
Well, I did okay with 100 on 40 meters, so I think that's, but it calculates to almost, just very close to 4,000 volts.
Wow. Well, that's terrific. And, of course, we encourage all of you to think about making up your own. And there are so many great websites. Bless that article in CQ, current issue of CQ, that talks about the relative efficiency of a small loop that you can put in your backyard. But this is great where they're using wide copper foil as well as that vacuum variable. So, Jim, you do what? You're tuning in on 40 of the smaller variable capacitor, right?
Yes, that variable capacitor is always in there, and that's the one that'll tune from about 10 megahertz all the way to, I think it's 28.7 or something like that, without the top one. By the way, the top one's about 140 picofarads, and it's also rated, I think it's 5,000 volts.
Wow. So next time you're at a swap meet, be sure and find an extra one for Gordo and Jim. And Jim, what have we got here?
That's the tuning indicator. Should you, well, you use that, but it's it works.
Yeah, a little NE2 neon. I bet it lights up nice and bright, and you've done a great job with that. Now, here's a motorized one that we have at Quartzfest each year, and it's remote controlled, so they can go ahead and do the tuning via remote. And for those that are thinking, gosh, this might work great in the attic or in my backyard, but I don't want to be running back and forth. Well, Chameleon has an answer, and I know other loop manufacturers do, and that is taking this particular device, tying it to a tripod, and one set of commands via the line will turn it, yet the other one will go ahead and tune it. So pretty neat that they have this little tripod that you could put in the backyard or up in the attic or somewhere where no one else will see it, and you're able to both tune as well as turn that loop antenna for best results. Now, you can also do it via the Chameleon down at the base, and they have a little adapter that instead of your hand, it is that automatic one. And Jim, how'd we do on comparison between like the $500 loop in the far ground and your relatively straightforward loop in the foreground, Jim?
I think I did pretty good. I think it, but I think they both work fine. But I mean, mine's copper, and it's maybe even a couple inches bigger, but it did good.
It did. And what we always encourage is be sure and watch the RF eddy currents that can creep down the feed line. Right, Jim?
That's right. And that's the reason why I have my loop on the bottom. You don't have to do that because it's below. And that's one advantage of having the loop on the bottom versus the top.
So you're not going to need a whole handful of chokes to try and get rid of that. The Amidon Mix 43 or Amidon Mix 61 with a mu of 850 allows that RF to stop right at the chokes, and even a little wrap like that will help. But this is what we do to keep any eddy currents from transferring over to the loop. Now, Jim, how about the Q down on 40 meters? So we got like 100 kilohertz?
Well, I think it's more like 13 or 14 kilohertz for 2:1.
Here we are on 72, 95 and a half, perfect SWR. And when we go up maybe or down a few kilohertz, what happens?
Oh, there is 2:1 right there.
So this really points out that the loop has great efficiency, spot-on frequency on transmit and receive. And on receive, the magnetic loop does not pick up electrical vertically polarized signals because it is magnetically. Now, we compared the loop to the Hi-Q antenna on the back of my wagon. And first thing we discovered was the loop was too close to the wagon. We've got to keep that loop absolutely in the clear, as you'll see in just a moment in Jim's backyard. But you can see that the tuning is on the bottom and the matching is on the top. And for Chameleon, they have both the hard aluminum loop as well as one that, as Tracy will recommend, that has coaxial cable that allows you to go ahead and take it. And, of course, when you're tuning the loop, you got to tune it and then what, step back a bit?
Absolutely. You interact with everything.
So here's the fellow in the tuning process. There's Jim pointing out the portability. Does that fit in your car?
Yes, just barely.
And Darcy, his wife, loves that. It gets stowed in the trunk. So we encourage all of you to think about the possibilities of the loop. It does not have to, the portable loop does not have to be mounted more than one, not wavelength, but one loop distance from the earth. For those that have a great earth like sandy soil that we're going to have 2 weeks from now during our Thanksgiving on the air on 20 meters, 14335, we're going to be testing different loops. And you may hear Jim's loop, the Chameleon loop, and many of the other loops that you see advertised in the DX Engineering catalog. And so, Jim, the loop is in your backyard, and it's playing, huh?
Yeah, it seemed to be working good. And I also used, at one point, a tripod of PVC just so it wouldn't, and this one, before I did that, but just so that it wouldn't introduce any losses because of the tripod. Now, there's probably not a lot there, but I'm trying to pay attention to details here.
Wow. Well, that's a real detailed loop. And so 2 weeks from this Thursday, Thanksgiving Day, 14.335, Chip Margelli, K7JA, and Gordo will be comparing our loops to, well, not necessarily a two-element beam, but we're going to be comparing our loops to a regular dipole antenna. And here's Tracy. And Tracy and I were, and Susie and Jody, we're up in the mountains off of Highway 49, and we had a great time. And as you can see, his Alex loop set up in just moments. And because there's no metal around to detune it and create eddy currents, that loop just did a great job. So we sure encourage all of you. Jim, any final words on loops?
Experiment.
That's right. And have fun experimenting and see what works. Give signal reports. And 2 weeks from now, we'll look forward to hearing you on the air, 14.335 on Thanksgiving Day. So put down the turkey bones and get ready for the loop. Well, George, we showed a lot of the vacuum variables. I bet you have some on those powerful transmitters. So in just a moment, Jim, thank you in 6JF for coming on board. And this is Gordo. George, how about those big vacuum variables? You must use those in the transmitters, huh?
Back in episode 350 of Ham Nation, I had a video here that is a continuing series that I've been doing since I'm a broadcast engineer. I presented a Tales from the Transmitter Site. This is a 1,000-gallon butane tank that feeds generator. The 480-volt three-phase feed coming into the facility, as well as a spare 1,000-gallon butane tank. And out there, you can see the field, which needs to be cut. This time of year, it's still too wet to get in there and cut it. Hopefully, they'll be able to do it before too long. Right now, I sure hope I don't have to go to those towers. There's three towers down there that are shorter than a quarter wavelength. The way they do that is top load the tower. Now there's another tower right here beside the building. And on top of it is a 950 megahertz link. That's the STL, or studio to transmitter link. That's how the audio gets out here. This is the generator transfer switch. This is what transfers the 480 volts between the utility coming in and the generator. Just a big relay and some control circuitry. And you can see where there's been a transformer meltdown in here one time. That was due to a lightning strike. And now we're entering the transmitter building. Down here at the far end, that blue and beige cabinet there, that is a 50 kilowatt AM transmitter. Nautel, made by the fine folks in Canada. It is solid state. It is a fraction of the size of a tube type 50 kilowatt transmitter. And since I've been here, it has been trouble free. It's not on right now. I'm operating on the nighttime transmitter, testing it. Right between the two transmitters here is a phaser cabinet. And this is what controls the switching between the three towers out there and a center tower. Now let's look inside. You adjust these dials here to adjust the phase and power distribution between the three towers. So what's inside the cabinet? Can't get far enough away to get a full shot of it. But this is basically it, the same thing you might see in an antenna tuner, or very similar. Just a lot of coils and capacitors, as well as a couple of RF contactors or relays. And that's what does the directional antenna magic. Now this little blue and black transmitter with the gray front is a 1 kilowatt solid state transmitter. We only run this one at night when we go directional and we have to reduce power. It's fairly quiet and runs fairly cool. And I've really had no trouble with this transmitter since I've been here either. Now in the rack next to this, got a UPS on top. Then that top unit there is a Marty STL receiver. That receives a 950 megahertz audio signal. And that's how we get the audio to the transmitter. Next is a modulation monitor, which is not switched to read right now while we're operating on this transmitter. Below that is the phase monitor, and this is how we measure the performance, or actually the power and phase between the three towers, is with this device right here. Below that, we've got an audio processor. This compresses the audio and limits it to keep us from over-modulating, but gives us a good loud signal. Below that is some more monitoring gear, a temperature sensor, and a remote control system where we can call in, take meter readings, make various changes on the transmitter site remotely. Now, all this stuff doesn't automatically connect together and everything just works. You've got to have a few relays to make that happen. And right here is the rat's nest that does that. Now, all of this was here before I got here, and I think it took two or three engineers to get it to this condition over the years. I have actually had to do some work in here before, and it's not easy since there's not a schematic of it. So I try to stay out of that as much as I can.
For the love of the holidays, surprise your favorite ham this season with the gift that's on their hot list. The holidays are just around the corner, and ICOM has plenty of cheer for everyone. IC7610, the SDR every ham wants, and just in time for the holidays. This high-performance SDR has the ability to pick out the faintest signals, even in the presence of stronger adjacent signals. The ICOM IC7610 is a direct sampling software-defined radio that will change the world's definition of a SDR. RF direct sampling system, 110 RMDR, independent dual receivers, and dual digicell. IC7300, changing the way entry-level HF is designed. This high-performance, innovative HF transceiver with a compact design will far exceed your expectations. RF direct sampling, 15 discrete bandpass filters, large 4.3-inch color touchscreen, real-time spectrum scope, and SD memory card slot. ICR30, raise the bar on DC to daylight receivers. Powerful yet easy to use, the ICR30 is packed full of features you've come to expect from ICOM. Built-in GPS and Bluetooth, dual bandwidth recording, high-speed scan, and there's an Android and iOS app available. The perfect stocking stuffer, the ID51A+2 provides new modes for extended D-Star coverage. Enjoy integrated GPS, independent AM/FM receiver, and free Android apps. Terminal and access point mode, send and receive text messages and pictures. DV fast data mode, and easy FM repeater setting. Visit ICOMAmerica.com/amateur for more information on all the great ICOM radios. You can tune in and enter to win after each episode of Ham Nation. Go to ICOMAmerica.com/hamnation and register to win some great swag prizes weekly like T-shirts and hats. And you'll automatically be entered in the monthly grand prize drawing for a new radio. And for December, that new radio is the ICOM ID5100A. It's a dual-band, dual-watch D-Star transceiver. It's got a large touchscreen display for easy operation, DV-DV and DV-FM dual-watch, built-in GPS, DV and FM repeater list function, SD memory card slot, and so much more. So go to ICOMAmerica.com/hamnation after this and each episode of Ham Nation and register to win. ICOM recently started a new promotion here. They realized that ham clubs play a big role in bringing the ham community together to learn from your peers and industry leaders. As a way to give back and help you on this mission, ICOM has launched a promotion exclusively for ham clubs and the ham fest they are involved with. By registering your club, you could win ICOM swag, a Skype presentation, or for your ham fest, an ICOM booth set up at your U.S. Ham Club. Register today for your chance to win. It's ICOMAmerica.com/hams. Thanks, ICOM. And another thing I like to do is play with Arduinos. There are so many projects that you can do with these little microcontrollers. They add to gear you've already got. Just a lot of different things, and I really like it. This is an idea I came up with right here because I had a real need for something. This is the first HF rig that I ever owned. It's a Yaesu 857D, and I used it for several years, and it worked fine. Eventually, though, I upgraded to other rigs, and this one sat on the shelf for several years. I decided that I would put it in the pickup truck that I own. It's kind of an extra vehicle. I don't drive that much, and I thought I might as well put an HF rig in there. I've got it, and I did. Unfortunately, after a couple of years, it developed a little problem. And I understand this is common to these rigs. You see the lines in the display there? Well, that's not very good. It makes it difficult to read the frequencies and other information on there. And the S-meter, is that S7 or is that S3 that we're looking at there? Well, it's kind of hard to tell, isn't it? My friend Wayne, KG5RE, has the same rig with the same problem. Supposedly, it's the display that's used in there.
It's mounted to a board with conductive epoxy, and after being in a hot vehicle for a period of time, that epoxy begins to break loose, and different segments go out in the display, as you can see there. And it's not a good situation. I don't think you can buy the display itself. You may can send the head in to Yaesu and have it repaired. I have not researched that option. I'm not sure what that cost. But I had some parts sitting around here, and I recall seeing Tommy's segment on a heads-up display for this exact rig back in episode 64 in March of 2014. And I thought, you know, I'll look around and see what parts I've got. Maybe I could just build a heads-up display and use that with this. Tommy had used a monochrome LCD display with his, and that would have worked, but I got to looking around, and I had this 3.5-inch TFT LCD screen for an Arduino. It claims to be a touchscreen. I bought this at Dayton Hamvention. However, upon further investigation, it's not a touchscreen at all, which is not a big deal to me. I was just thinking $20. That's not a bad price for, you know, a graphics display that does RGB color. And this is it right here. It's based on an ILI 9481 display. And I found that those are available from banggood.com currently for only $10.73. On the rear of it, it doesn't say anything about being a touchscreen. There is a micro SD card slot on it, which I don't need right now, but could be handy for something in the future. And it takes a lot of I.O. pins to operate this. If you tried to use it with an Arduino Uno, you'd use up most all the I.O. pins that are available on there. So I'm going to be using it with Arduino Mega instead. Now, the Mega's got a little more memory on it and a lot more I.O. pins. And as a matter of fact, the example code I found on the display, the guy was using a Mega, so shouldn't have any problems there. You just mate the display onto the I.O. pins of the Mega, and I've still got plenty of I.O. pins left over on the sides here. I'm only going to use pins 52 and 53 along with the ground to connect the TX and RX for serial communications. But there's plenty of I.O. ports left for other projects. You could put controls on there, push buttons, anything you wanted, but I'm not going to do that at this point. We'll hook pin 52 of the Arduino to the TX connection on the CAT/linear connector and pin 53 of the Arduino to the RX pin on the connector and, of course, ground on the Arduino to ground on the connector. That pretty much covers the hardware portion of the project. Of course, I'll want to build some kind of box to mount this into. Now let's look at the software. And here, I'm not going to reinvent the wheel. I'm going to search on the internet, find the individual pieces that I need to the puzzle, and then assemble them in a way that will do what I need. The first piece here is a CAT library to work with the FT-857D. Fortunately, James Buck, VE3BUX, wrote one several years ago. This is the same one that Tommy used on his heads-up display, and that will save us a lot of work. Now, you can do this project for any rig that supports CAT command or serial commands, but you'll have to do a little work. You can find this library at VE3BUX.com. The next piece we're going to need is some way to do the serial communications between the Arduino and the rig. Unfortunately, our display uses the pins that would normally be used for serial communications. However, we can use the software serial library that's included with the Arduino IDE to use other pins. Now, just keep in mind that some pins on the Arduino will not work with this library. The two that we're using, 52 and 53, are supported by it. You can find more information at arduino.cc. We'll need software to translate commands to our display. Unfortunately, the LCD display library that comes with the Arduino IDE will not work with this display. I did a little searching, and I found the driver we need on GitHub at the address shown on the screen. It allows us to do most of the basic graphic commands on the ILI 9481 display. However, there's no text characters defined in the library. For that, we'll use the Adafruit GFX library that comes with a lot of included fonts, plus you can add your own fonts to it. Now, that's four different pieces of software I've downloaded. I'll need to write the code to tie all these together, but there's one more function I want to add that I don't think I've ever seen on a rig before. You know, I've got a little extra room on this display because it's fairly good size, so I thought, why don't I put a count-up timer on it so that anytime you key the transmitter, it will start counting and let you know how long you've been transmitting. And that could be handy to help you avoid timing out a repeater or any number of things. Now, a simple timer like that could easily be written on the Arduino, but I found one someone had already written, which meant it's been tested, and it works well, so that will save us a lot more time. You can find the count-up countdown timer at arduino.cc on the link I'm showing here on the screen. Now, most of this code is not super complicated. However, there's a good deal of it, more than we can cover here in this video. So I'm just going to give you a link here to the file where you can download the code and look at it yourself or actually use it in a project of your own. Well, let's see if this was worth all the effort. I could be looking at this on the display, and I might be able to guess what frequency I'm on, or I could be looking at this. Now, the exposure's been turned down on the camera, so it's not quite as bright as it is in real life. It looks much better to the naked eye than it does through a camera. At the top there, I've got my call sign, my name, and then I'm displaying the mode, lower sideband, and RX4 receive, and then I've got a big, nice display there to show me the frequency, and of course, I'm in megahertz. And down at the bottom, I've got the S units displayed as a numerical value, and a bar graph that shows it as a graphic. When we begin transmitting, the indicator changes to TX, and the bar graph then displays power output, and it's a red bar there. The banding that you're seeing on it is not on the display, it's just an anomaly of the camera photographing it. And it's not actually calibrated to power output, it's just a rough approximation. In this case, we were transmitting with lower sideband, so you can see that modulation is affecting the power output. If we change modes to AM, then you'll notice it's a solid carrier there when we transmit. This is an inexpensive display, and it has a serial connection to the radio. If by chance the screen should become garbled, you can force it to redraw by just switching the radio to the packet mode. That way you don't have to power cycle the display in order to refresh the screen. Now here's a feature that I don't know that I've seen on a radio before. It's our count-up timer that keeps track of how long you've been keyed. You know, when you get excited or enthusiastic about a subject, it's easy to talk longer than you realize. This should help you prevent timing out repeaters. This display is not as nice as I've seen on radios that, you know, come with built-in color displays. However, it does help make this old radio a little more comfortable to operate, especially now that I can read the frequency again. As I mentioned earlier, you could build this project for any radio that has CAT or serial commands on it. You could also expand it a lot with push buttons and such to give you a lot of different functions. It just depends on how much time you want to put into it. This project was a lot of fun to build, and I got a lot of enjoyment out of tinkering a little bit with the Arduino and putting that display to work. And the bonus is, I can actually use this radio again. I hope you enjoyed that. You know, as I mentioned, you can do that with other rigs than just this particular one, but you would have to change that code in there to do that. But I heard from a lot of people, and they really enjoyed that. Thanks, everyone, for watching Ham Nation this year and supporting our sponsors. We really appreciate it. You know, it's always great to be able to share projects and ideas with your community, And that's what we're doing right here at Ham Nation each week. Thanks for joining us. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Hey, Ham Nation viewers. This is Amanda, K1DDN. I always appreciate you watching my segments. And unfortunately, I bring you a lot of segments that have to do with MCOM and disasters from Mother Nature. I hate doing that, but I hope you take a lot out of them. This one, we're going to be talking about the campfire in Paradise, California. And the destruction was massive, but ham radio played a huge role. And I just hope everyone gets a lot out of it, take some lessons from it, and we can all improve from there. We have the section emergency coordinator of the Sacramento Valley. That's Greg, KG6SJT. Sorry, Greg, I almost forgot your call sign there, but thanks for joining us tonight.
That's okay. Yes, good evening.
First of all, let's talk about a couple of things. Tell us, how is the Paradise fire going right now? In case any of our viewers don't know what's happening there right now, go ahead and give us kind of the rundown.
Okay, well, for the Paradise, that was a complete disaster up there. The fire was rushing so fast. It started on last Thursday morning, about 1,000 acres, and by that evening it had grown to 20,000 acres. And this is in a mountainous area with lots of trees and brush. Because we had high winds, a gust up to 50 miles an hour, it just zoomed. The town of Paradise was mostly destroyed, and there were 25,000 people. Well, I think the town had 25,000 people, or 27,000, excuse me. And it's nearly totally destroyed. They're doing search and rescue now, looking for bodies, and it's going up it's gone up twice today. Currently, 56 people have lost their lives in this fire.
Mm. That's
a lot
that's
of elderly,
terrible.
Retired people live there.
So, if I know correctly, there's about 6,750 homes destroyed, and about 230 commercial or business properties. Is that correct?
The latest update I got just a few minutes ago was there were 10,321 structures destroyed, which includes 8,650 homes, and there's still 15,000 still being threatened by the blaze.
Okay, so horrible numbers there, first of all. This is the most destructive wildfire in California, first of all, not to mention most of the U.S., minus maybe the Chicago fire back in the 1800s. Anyhow, let's move on. So what is Ares doing right now, or what have they done? They've been supporting some shelters, and you've got some operators there. Go ahead and tell us about that.
Well, that's correct. We have a good working relationship with the Gold Coast Region Red Cross, which is located centrally in Sacramento, California. They call us out when they open Red Cross shelters. Even if their communications initially, they're concerned that if the communications go down, which they did, they need to have operators there. You can't call for them if they're not around. So we ended up supporting, in the end, 5 shelters, and they were up from Chico all the way down to Gridley and as far east as Plumas County. The operation involved about 20 operators, and we were staffing them anywhere from 12 to 24 hours a day. Let's see what else to tell you about it. Anyway, we actually got released last night about 7:00. The communications infrastructure, the cell phones are stabilized now. They did go out for a while, but now they're working fine. So they said, we don't need you, but don't go far. You're on standby.
That's absolutely correct. And why don't we talk about some of the traffic that you passed? You were basically going from shelters to the Red Cross chapter to tell them how many people were there, how many meals they needed. Is that the kind of traffic you were passing?
That's correct. We were passing shelter counts and tactical messages from the shelters to Red Cross. If they had questions, I know in one case there was a question. They had an EMT that had a license that he hadn't had registered with Red Cross, so they had to get that clarified. So that went back and forth. Some of that was on voice. Actually, all the stations had voice, but then most of the stations had Winlink, which is the we found to be the go-to method for communications of these wildfires. It worked extremely well during the car fire this summer. And using the Winlink, we can use the forms that are built into the system to send shelter counts and ICS 213 forms, putting together ICS 205, the communication channels and plan, and sending all of that back to Red Cross to be shared with the other shelters and people that need to know that.
Absolutely. And I think Winlink is a great resource. And first of all, it's because it is kind of a digital mode that you get the information accurate. There's no second guessing how many people are there. There's no second guessing the needs. Was it 23 cots? Was it 33 cots? It all comes over digitally in a form with a request. And it's much more accurate. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Because I work with the Winlink group helping develop forms, I was had seen some of the messages from Puerto Rico. And in one case, it was a list of medications. It must have been 30 of them or 40 on a page. And if you had to pass those by voice, it would take about maybe a week. They were, long words. Long and a lot of spelling would be involved. And sometimes just a few letters could make a difference.
Oh, agreed. And especially coming out of Puerto Rico with the Spanish translations, I can imagine how hard that would be. But let's move on here. We have a couple of other things to talk about. First of all, we have some photos to show the audience as well, but this was really destructive. Not only that, but you had some people working in those shelters that actually lost their homes themselves. This guy right here, I think it's the guy on the right. He lost his home and went right to a shelter to help. Is that correct?
That's correct. The fellow on the left, and I just blanked out on his name. But yes, he was. His family lost their home.
And it's so devastating. You're called to work even though you lost your home. And this is kind of their portable setup there for Sacramento Valley and some of the other.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
One group took that up. And initially they were outside because Red Cross didn't have a place to put them. But they remedied that quickly because it was very smoky outside.
Yeah, I can't even imagine that working. This is John. I became friends with him on Facebook. The John, also KM6ICQ is his call sign. He lost his house and he volunteers for an animal rescue group. And he didn't even skip a beat. He lost his home, took his three dogs and went to go help all the other animals out there that were lost and waiting to find their owners who either A, had left home for the day and couldn't get back home to go get their pets. And this is what he's been doing. And this poor cat, he's been doing some serious work. He has a GoFundMe site, but I won't put that out here. But he's been doing some hard work himself. And then just the other pictures, you can just see. This is one of the shelters getting all of these donations, and you can see the outside picture where there's just so much going on. I've never seen such a devastating fire in my life. I've worked a lot of fires here in Colorado, and I've seen some distraught people at shelters, but this is beyond belief, honestly, to see that this town has just been completely destroyed. So,
yeah, as of this evening, there are, 1,385 people in shelters.
And how many shelters are still open?
I think there are five Red Cross shelters, but there are multiple ones being hosted by churches and smaller entities that are not registering with the Red Cross, but they're offering sheltering.
Okay, and I I gave Victor a link. I know, Victor, you're going through pictures for me here, but this is a really interesting link from Cal Fire. And on it, if you scroll into that, Victor, look at that. I mean, there's just a sea of red. But once you get into where you can see the icons of houses, all you have to do is click on one of those homes. And then you can see there. If you click on it, then you can click on the image and it will show you the destruction of the home. So Cal Fire does an amazing job at this. And this is really heartbreaking, by the way. This is what's left of this person's home. And they have this document online for everyone to go out and check out. And I just can't imagine finding out that your home is lost by this. But it is a great tool, but devastating at the same time, don't you think, Greg?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Excuse me. Yeah, when they posted that, I posted it on our website, which is www.sacvalleyaries.org, and also the section Facebook and Twitter pages, because it really helps. And you can find out what happened. And if you know people up there, you can put in an address and it'll show you where it's at. And it comes in handy. Also, we did do some reunification, or at least finding people, during this event. We had a ham contacted me. He was trying to find somebody, but he didn't have a computer. And I was able to search the fellow's name on the Red Cross Safe and Well website, and we found out that he was staying in a hotel. And then Red Cross at the radio station also helped reunite two people. One fellow, he was calling in. Somebody called with an HT. It was, I think, his wife. She couldn't get to him. He couldn't hear her. So Red Cross relayed that and told her not to come up because it was up to Paradise. And there was another one as well. So.
It just, the devastation. I think all of us viewers here just overwhelmed by it. I know Southern California is going through the same thing. I don't think so much as Northern California right now. But really, I really appreciate, Greg, all the information. And I know your ops are just spread far and few between there, and you work out of a really kind of rural area. So finding your operators in the first place are hard to come by. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. We have 20 counties in our section, but many of them are small with, you know, just a few thousand people. The areas groups for a given county, if they have 15 people, they're lucky. So we rely a lot on mutual assistance, where one county gets involved and then neighboring counties come in to help out. They ask for that assistance, and that works well. So that's why we encourage people to, well, besides training all the time, get to know all your neighboring counties, become familiar with the people and how they work, because you're going to be called out. I mean, during the fire this summer, we had people driving 5.5 hours to help out because there were no operators up in the northern part of the state.
Absolutely. I live with the same thing here in Colorado. It's just how it is. We live in rural areas and we don't have that many hams, and definitely not ones that have volunteered to be part of ARES or trained. So it's hard to find the ones that you want to trust to put in those positions. So I understand completely. Before we wrap it up here, is there anything else you want to tell us about what's going on there or how things are going?
Well, they're going, for us, they're going better, because all the ARES operators were released last night, I may have mentioned, because the telecoms and cells are all working. And Red Cross is more comfortable with that. You know, they know how to use their cell phones and fax machines, but they want us to be right on nearby in case they're needed. So that's it. I would say all ARES groups should be reaching out to their neighboring counties, get to know them, train, and ideally everybody gets at least familiar with WinLink. WinLink was our go-to tool. They gave us the best results, and even people that don't have a terminal node connector, or TNC. Once they get started, they can do it over Telnet, which is just using the internet, but at least they know how the program functions. So if they're assigned to a shelter, they would know which buttons to push when it is hooked to a radio.
Agreed, my friend. It's all about training and learning all of this stuff before you're thrown into the situation. So, Greg, I'd like to really thank you for joining us tonight.
For the Best Of Show, we've decided to put the news on the back burner and reflect a little bit on 2018 for just a minute. For me personally, it was the most amazing year. I found my birth family, discovered I have a sister, and I'm no longer an only child. That was in February. In September, I attended my 40th high school reunion and met my sister, cousins, aunts, and uncles that until this year I never knew I had. So to say that I'm blessed is the understatement of the century. My son Tyler, N7TMW, graduated from high school and started college. My wife found a new job. I will start my 11th year at iHeart New Orleans in 2019, and life is pretty good. Of course, like always, there are challenges. There always are. The key, though, is don't dwell on the hard stuff. Just push through it. You're going to need a little help from friends and family, but you got to push through it. That is the key. And as we look ahead to 2019, my 25th year as a licensed radio amateur, I've decided that one of my resolutions is to get on the air more. I'm going to seriously try to make at least one contact every day. It might just be on the local repeater, might be on HF, maybe D-Star, maybe I'll try some satellite. See, that's the thing with this hobby and service. The sky is literally the limit. And I challenge you to get on the air more as well. Even if you're a brand new tech, you can still get on the local repeaters. Try D-Star, DMR, or Fusion. Try some of the other digital modes, maybe some contesting. Like Forrest Gump's proverbial box of chocolates, you never know what you'll get. Another worthy endeavor is to try to get kids involved with ham radio. Maybe your club can set up field day style in a park. Maybe just do it yourself. If your local high school has a robotics team or ROTC unit, that would be a great place to start. If not, contact a science teacher or other technical teacher, maybe a counselor. Again, you never know what'll come of it. My involvement over the last 25 years with Newsline and the Young Ham of the Year has been nothing short of amazing. And it's all because of these great kids that are in this hobby. And so in closing, I'd like to say, just get out there. Push the envelope a little bit. Get out of your comfort zone. You'll be better for it, and you might find a new comfort zone. So for my family, and all of us here with Amateur Radio Newsline and Ham Nation, we wish you the happiest of New Year's. 7-3. We'll see you in 2019.
Hey, Ham Nation fans, you guys are the greatest, and I hope you all have a very happy holiday season. And as the song says, may all your days be sunny and bright.
Merry and bright.
Oh, merry and bright. Nah, I like mine better. Have a great new year, too.
Thanks, viewers, for watching Ham Nation this last year. We always appreciate you. We've had such a blast here. Jeff and I would like to wish you all happy holidays and happy new year for sure. We've had such a blast being able to show you our stories on the show, from Last Man Standing set operations to all of our MCOM services. It's a whirlwind, and I can't keep up. And I can't wait to share all of our next year's stories with you as well. 73. Merry Christmas, happy holidays, and happy new year.
This is Dan, N9LVS, wishing all the Ham Nation viewers a Merry Christmas and a happy new year.
Hi, I'm Dale at A0HYD. We're on the Yellow Brick Road, about 100 feet north of it, actually, in south central Kansas, just west of Wichita. We'd like to thank our Ham Nation viewers around the world. It's an amazing fraternity we have here on Ham Nation. I get birthday greetings from New Zealand and Australia before anyone here in the States. It's just an amazing phenomenon. So we appreciate your videos, each and every one of you that have sent one in. And we appreciate your shack photos also. We'd like to highlight them for you next year in 2019. And we can do that if you send them to us. And, of course, the address you need to send them, you just email the video link or you email the photos and attach them to the email to hamnationvideos@twit.tv. that Ham Nation videos is all one word. Well, that's about it for 2018. It's been a pleasure to be here this last several months, and we hope to see more of you. And for now, we'd like to wish you, all of your friends, and all of your family, everyone you know, a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, along with a prosperous 2019.
Hi, I'm Bob Heil, host of Ham Nation. And this has been the best of the 2018 shows on Ham Nation. I do hope that you enjoyed each of the segments, and especially the segment that I did on the Pine Board. We have so many people learn to build, and hopefully they'll get on the air and have more fun with the projects that they built and learned about right here on Ham Nation. I do hope that you will join us for all of the shows on 2019, because we got a lot of things coming up. So thanks to all the hosts, thanks to all the producers, and especially to Leo Laporte for the time here on Twit Network. We will see you in 2019. Happy New Year, and have a great time.